Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 136, a special episode in which we revisit one of our prior conversations on a classic of organization theory. Today, we go back to Max Weber's famous book chapter, Bureaucracy, published in his 1922 book, Economy and Society, and covered in this program in episode 6, which we released in January 2016. To learn more about the text and the original episode, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Rohin from London.
Hi, and this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And today we are doing another one of our revisit episodes where we take an old episode and re-release it. And then what we're going to do is add some additional commentary. It's like an extension of the original episode. The original episode that we're going to cover this time is number 6, which is on Weber's Bureaucracy. And this is the chapter 11 from the 1922 book, Economy and Society. And the reason why we chose that, there's sort of like a contemporary focus on bureaucracy right now. And we have referred to Weber probably more than any other episode apart from Tristan Bamforth, who we did our last revisit on last year. But bureaucracy is under a lot of scrutiny, and there's sort of like, especially in the contemporary time, a lot of conflict over what bureaucracy really means, what was its original purpose under Weber. And one of the reasons is because bureaucracy is under a whole different set of myths and pressures than it was in 2015 when the original episode was released. And the team that did the cast members who did the original episode focused a lot on certain aspects of bureaucracy, like, for example, the routinization of tasks, the way that bureaucracies form, a lot of things from the chapter. But given that the conversation is now moving towards a whole different set of challenges, we thought this would be a good time to take another look at the chapter and perhaps add to that conversation.
Yeah, and I think having now, in my case, visited the text for the first time since, again, I wasn't on episode 6 either, it becomes even more apparent that what Weber was writing was a product of that time, and bringing that context in and then moving the context to today leads to a lot of interesting comparisons with what bureaucracy means and versus what it meant.
So if I was to characterize sort of the direction we're going to go, at least at the beginning, the original episode focused a lot on the micro and the meso aspects of bureaucracy that Weber highlights. And I think one of the things we want to do, because this sort of befits the current discourse where bureaucracy is under a different form of attack, is to take a look at bureaucracy through the lens of institutional logics. Bureaucracy as an institutional logic. Because a lot of how we define bureaucracy as an institutional logic comes from this chapter. I mean, it's not like the institutional theorists took this whole thing in a different direction. It's very consistent. We see in the discourse a lot of competition against market logics. So very definitely a strong public-private rift between how bureaucracies function as a means for providing for stability, consistency, reliability on tasks, on the performance of tasks, and market logics, which are a completely different institutional logic, much more focused on efficiency, profit, market shares, financial incentives, and all that sort of thing. So that's sort of the lens that we're going to kind of start with And the current conversation, of course, this is very much aligned with current conversations, because when we think a lot of the institutions that have been built around bureaucracies, and we're not just talking about government, we're talking about private sector, universities, all those that have embraced some sort of bureaucracy in order to be able to function, a lot of them are facing significant challenges from other institutional logics, especially market logics and other logics.
Yeah, I also think there's definite value add to moving towards this, or rather to bringing in the institutional logics perspective, not just because of the changing phenomenon, as you laid out, Tom, but also because of it was something missing anyways in the original Weber piece. And of course, this was written more than 100 years ago at this point, well, published more than 100 years ago, written prior to that as well. Because what we discussed and what listeners will hear in parts one and two of this episode were Weber's ideal types, let's say, of, you know, he had three ideal types. He had your kind of rational legal authority, which is where bureaucracy sits, then the charismatic authority and traditional authority. Weber, in passing, allows for this idea of what we would now call multiple logic. So he says that you can have multiple kind of these types, but he's focused very much on multiple types of legitimacy, which is kind of the basis. So he calls it, the basis of these kinds of authority is the belief that someone has that this is legitimate, whether it's legitimate because it's in the law, or it's legitimate because it's passed down through tradition, or it's legitimate because you find the leader to be charismatic and you want to follow. Weber allows for the idea that it could be multiple of these. So I as the follower could believe that this is legally legitimate and traditionally valid and the leader is charismatic, but that still doesn't tell us anything about what to expect in terms of how things work then at the institutional level. So there might be multiple bases of legitimacy driving some kind of a hybrid institution, but I think the logics lens now lets us discuss what that might look like and how these conflicting forces that organizations face today play out in terms of then how they shape themselves and what activities they engage in.
Yeah, and I like that you brought that up, because it's not like organizations wholly embrace one institutional logic. And it's not just a matter of the institutional logics themselves, but also their interaction. And there's a lot of literature that we can bring in regarding the conflict. You know, how do conflicts between institutional logics resolve? Let me present some institutional logics and show how they are sort of connected to or conflicting with bureaucracy. And then we can talk about those, you know, how those conflicts meet out. I already mentioned markets, and we see a lot of push to try to have market logics impose upon those that have traditionally been bureaucratic institutions out of efficiency. And the particular type of efficiency is that of monetary efficiency, if you will, to do things faster, better, cheaper. So when it was brought up in episode 6, it was sort of the difference between technical efficiency, which would be more of a market logic, where it is you make each transaction or each action as efficient as possible, as cheap, faster, or more effective, whereas bureaucracy is much more of a productive efficiency. When we think about moving towards stability, it's the overall ability to provide a service. The example I like to use, which I know you're in London, you have this wonderful public transportation system. And from a bureaucratic standpoint, of course, when we think about stability, there are plenty of times in which the underground, you know, has lines running at midnight that are not anywhere close to full, at least compared to rush hour or whatever. And so the bureaucratic logic would say, well, you want to provide that service at that time, even if it isn't full, because people depend upon it, as opposed to a more technically efficient, market-driven type that would say, no, we would cut those late-night lines, because it's losing money compared to increasing lines during rush hour. And of course, then you get into the upper bound of the maximum capacity for the infrastructure to be able to handle more trains at certain times. So obviously that's a balance. There's the professional logic, which is from Elliot Friedson, 2001. And he wrote that book as an express differentiation following Abbott, which we've done a couple episodes on, but as distinct from market and bureaucratic logics, in which it's all about specialized knowledge, peer recognition, expertise, duty and service orientation. Definitely not efficient in the classic sense either way between market and bureaucratic. It is efficient in its own way, in which the most, where it's all about effectiveness, best expert-driven solution treatment is what should be provided. And the quality of the work is what is all about the logic. If the work is not done as effectively as possible, then more research, knowledge, whatever should be developed in order to do that. Then the fourth one, which is another one that is presently putting a lot of pressure on bureaucracies, is it's a class of logics all centered around a central authority or figure. So for example, a family business logic, where a patriarch or a matriarch is the one running the show. And it doesn't have to be a family person. You see similar things in community logics where there's a central board of directors or a city council in which runs everything. Even in the private sector, if we want to think about a Steven Jobs, who was a very central figure who really directed the path, and this set of institutional logics all have some things in common, in which the central ruler or the central ruling authority has consolidated significant power. Centralization is a big part of that logic. Obedience and alignment with the views of the central authority are at the centerpiece. And it actually conflicts with all three of the other logics in a way, because it doesn't value stability the same way as bureaucracy does. It may value financial incentives only to the extent that the financial incentives or the profit margins aid in centralizing power. And in terms of professionalism, it definitely is the opposite of that, because professionalism is much more democratizing of knowledge and expertise, which would be the antithesis of having centralized control. And I think my last point on this for the moment is that none of these institutional logics are good or bad. And I think Weber in his bureaucracy chapter was very, very clear that he saw bureaucracy as a very successful way of doing things, but he did not attach a valence to it per se. And the institutional logics, you could come up with reasons why any organization dominated by one logic could be very successful, very good, or very unsuccessful and very bad. So there's a lot more to what makes a particular organization under these logics good or bad.
Yeah, and I think to some, there's some of what you said, Tom, that we can still pull out of Weber, and then a lot of what you said is indeed missing, and I don't want to say missing in the sense that he didn't think of it. It perhaps wasn't even as relevant then as it is now. A quick point on, I totally agree with you that kind of Weber does seem to see it as technically superior. So he's giving it a rational valence, but not an emotional valence, where we know from other writings that he does sometimes ascribe the phrase disenchantment of the modern world because of all of this, and then the famous metaphor of the iron cage. And so if anything, there might be a negative emotional valence from a meaning making and human perspective to that level of bureaucratization. Now, the bit that we can pull out of Weber is when he talks about charismatic authority. He talks a little bit about what we might see in family businesses or Steve Jobs, for example. And he has an interesting point there where he says it's inherently unstable and it'll tend towards one of the other two types of authority over time. So the charismatic will either become bureaucratic, or what he calls rational legal authority, or it'll become traditional. So for example, if In the case of Apple, it's perhaps become the more rational legal, where it's let's find a competent CEO. They don't have to at all be charismatic. They can keep a low profile, or they can just focus on the technical aspects of the job. Had it been a different company where the founder decides to hand it over to their next generation, and so keep it like a hereditary leadership, that would be a move from charismatic to traditional authority, where now it's kind of just vested in that family over the years, which we see in family businesses quite often, especially the ones that stay private. There, it's not under his conception of bureaucracy, it's under his kind of broader conception of those three authority types. And there's some sense of movement from one to the other over time, specifically charismatic because it's less stable. But I don't think he fully accounts for the fact that we'll see multiple in a big way. So Apple is a great example where Steve Jobs was highly charismatic, but Apple as an organization was still very bureaucratically effective. In fact, it is a more centralized organization, always has been compared to Google, for example. And so we see those logics play out in a bigger way, perhaps, than Weber allowed for, or at least hinted at even implicitly. But that's something we can pull out from there. I think one thing that you brought up that's missing, I would say, from the earlier conversation on and the Weberian view on bureaucracy is the almost internal conflicting logics, because efficiency itself can mean multiple things. So Weber's bureaucracy is focused on the predictability, reliability, and kind of calculability. These are all phrases that he uses, which is also a form of efficiency. So it would mean, for example, that you have very few manufacturing defects in your product, and so there's very few recalls, product recalls, things like that, which is its own form of efficiency, but it's really more about reliability and calculability, which is what Weber is talking about. But then you have the kind of market efficiency of, maybe I should offshore some of my production. I should outsource to different countries. I should lower my cost of manufacturing. And that's a different kind of efficiency that might have different logics to it. And then there's a third one, which I want to add in as well, which is that idea of innovation and creative destruction as another market need. I found Weber's conception to be quite, you know, and it was written in an era when Taylor was also writing his work. And, you know, these were being written separately and in different languages, but the ideas must have been in the air of efficiency being about control and predictability and that view of efficiency. But it totally kind of ignores a Schumpeterian worldview where it's less about doing the same thing every time with perfect precision and more about renewing every, you know, few years and disrupting yourself and things like that. And so that's another thing that's completely missing from this view. I love the tube example, i.e. the London Underground, where you can think of the Weberian logic of efficiency is about predictable timing. For example, it's always there the same time. If I need one at midnight, it's there because it's supposed to. It's not going to stop going just because there's no passengers. If it's on the schedule, it will be there. But the market cost logic is more, like you said, where they decide which routes are profitable, which are not, and the midnight route is just shut down. And then perhaps the innovation logic is they decide to do dynamic pricing and or personalized ads on the tube or what have you. And then the professional logic, Tom, would be that passengers are the clients and they care about the relationship as well with the client. So then that also changes your option set of what you do. So it's a great example that captures how, and something as innocuous, we're not talking about a multinational corporation with $100 billion in revenue, but even that at the local city level faces so many conflicting logics.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I'll kind of add that, you know, what you're kind of highlighting is that, you know, perhaps Weber, he certainly didn't realize this at the time, but he was presenting the existence of conflicting institutional logics. He was setting the stage for that conversation in here. The charismatic leader would effectively impose a particular logic over a bureaucratic organization, shaping the bureaucratic organization to value its activities in line with providing for what the central authority wants or the central authority needs, which is a conflict between the pure bureaucratic logic and the pure central figure, logic. I guess I'll use that term to characterize that set of logics. I think there's good consistency there, so it's still useful for understanding some of the things, like, for example, one of my favorite parts from the original episode is when they started talking about the ox metaphor, and that the bureaucracy is like an ox that just simply is going in a particular direction. If the direction happens to be the right one, that's good. But if it happens to be in the wrong one, it's not necessarily bad as long as everybody is following along with the ox. Of course, that's where, perhaps rather than thinking about other institutional logics as conflicting, there's something to be said about having something reining in the ox, which is, I think, part of what the current discourse is about. Bureaucracy, when bureaucracy becomes its own end to itself, no matter how good the rules are or whatever, if it actually is taking the public, the society, the organization in the wrong direction, somebody's got to figure out how to turn the thing. And I like that you brought up creative destruction, the innovative logic. The question then becomes, okay, how does the bureaucracy, recognize that it's turned into an ox going down this long, dirty path and is about to enter some mud? And it's got to be turned around and put in a new direction.
Yeah, and I think in some sense, there's a little bit of this that is implicit in Weber, and he implicitly puts it out of scope, which is what happens when that system of authority or system of control loses legitimacy, because he's only discussing legitimate systems of control. And so by definition, all of his work assumes that. But you could have, for example, the Steve Jobs, let's take that kind of the charismatic authority, the one leader on top. If they become a tyrant, but, well, let's say in Weber's words, it's not so much whether they're a tyrant or not. It's about whether the people, the followers of Steve Jobs, perceive him to be effective, magical, a genius, or more of a tyrant with no value. But moment that happens, it's no longer charismatic authority in Weber's typology. In fact, it falls out of the typology altogether, because these ideal types are all about legitimate authority. And so in each case, whether it's a bureaucracy or a traditional authority or a charismatic authority, it could lose legitimacy over time. And then that leads to these challenges, which are nowhere to be seen necessarily in this particular reading that we've done at this point. So I do think that's an implicit point that readers might not pick up on, but that each of these three types could lose legitimacy, and then we don't know what happens next.
Right, and that legitimacy, and I guess we can perhaps try to unpack what are the signs of that, because he did have some in here. I think it was page 993, the ruler's dependence on the bureaucracy. Yeah, the absolute monarch is powerless in the face of the superior knowledge of the bureaucratic expert, in a certain sense more so than any other political head. This is a good part to kind of unpack a bit, because, on its face, I think that in contemporary times, that would be a statement. I marked it as a statement of, we should question this. Is this really true? Because like you were saying, if that absolute monarch, or the absolute leader, CEO, whatever, or the founder of a family business has legitimacy, then, well, yeah, they'll face down the bureaucracy. They'll have tremendous influence. There's like all sorts of different ways in which that legitimacy can be lost. And some of it has to do with whether or not the organization starts to fail. And I'm using air quotes here. Because, of course, I think we've talked in previous episodes that there's a rather fluid sense of what do we mean by an organization failing, as in the difference between an actual failure, such as, a restaurant chain that ends up sickening a whole bunch of people because of poor food safety, versus a perception of failure, which is to say that they are competing with another firm, and therefore the two firms are just naturally going to accuse each other of being incompetent, simply because that's part of the institutionalized way in which they compete. They don't promote themselves, they put down everybody else. But at some point, that legitimacy, it's where the followership starts to lose their sense of commitment to the leader.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I'm glad you pointed out that section as well, because so one thing is that, yeah, we don't know what happens after. So Weber does reference the fact that there is this inverse dependency as well, but we've seen cases where that doesn't matter. And we've seen cases where regardless of that dependency, there's failure, but what happens after the failure? The one thing that came to my mind, though, is that the reason perhaps that kind of the dependency of the leader on the bureaucrats, it might even be less in our times than when Weber was writing, is because of how the relationship we have now in the information age, in the misinformation age, to knowledge. In the kind of the underpinning of Weber's point of bureaucracy is that power comes from the facts or from knowledge. In fact, in kind of the earlier chapters, so page 225, he says, bureaucratic administration means fundamentally domination through knowledge. And so his idea of, let's say, the bureaucrats having power over the charismatic authority is the knowledge, the technical knowledge that the bureaucrats have. So if this was Steve Jobs, it's the, you know, head of product development or the head of engineering, head of sales, knowing more, and Jobs having to bow down to that knowledge. If it's a government, it's the Department of Health or Defense or whatever, knowing more, and then the head of state having to kind of, again, bow down to, not necessarily to the people, but to the power of their knowledge. We can now see with time that that's a very modernist take, and in a postmodern world, maybe just because your direct reports have more knowledge than you doesn't mean they have much power over you or that it's kind of a dependence necessarily.
Yeah, and it's also a matter of whether or not the technical expertise or the professional expertise is valued or trusted. And I think that when we're talking about profession versus bureaucracy, there is tension because, of course, the expertise of the profession is paramount. But as we saw in Abbott, there is a time in which knowledge accumulates to the point where one can move away from needing professional judgment and it becomes routinized information, which can then be put into a bureaucracy, given an algorithm. And there the legitimacy then becomes, okay, at which point is that actually true? For some areas of expertise, and I'd like to use medicine as a good example where we're seeing this, there's that social contract between the doctor and the patient that the doctor is giving their expert opinion for diagnosis and treatment and all that sort of thing. If the pressure is to make that more conform to either a market logic, which is to say, okay, doctor, you only have 15 minutes per appointment and you're going to exercise your judgment within that time. Or a bureaucratic one that says that, doctor, you must get approval from the insurance adjuster before you start doing anything to make sure that the insurance is going to cover it. Where's the risk in that? The one offended in this is not going to be necessarily looking at the bureaucracy or the market, the ones who are outside of that relationship with the doctor, it's going to be a loss of trust with the doctor. That's a bit of an overstatement. A lot of people like to blame insurance agents too, but.
No, but what you're bringing up is a theme that we also saw in parts one and two of episode six, which was that question of bureaucracy for whom. We can zoom that out to all of these institutional logics for whom, whether it's the market logic or the bureaucratic logic. And so then I love the doctor example because exactly there, perhaps part of the reason we see the almost do your own research movement sometimes or the, you know, anti-vax, etc. Now, whether regardless of moral valence to it, part of it could be because the bureaucracy serves the insurance company or what have you. And so whereas a professional logic would be prioritizing the client, perhaps the bureaucratic logic has a momentum of its own. And then the clients, in this case, the patients are having to, are kind of deviating, and that deviation is a collapse in the success of that organization or in the success of the bureaucratic form of organizing.
Yeah. And here's another wrinkle, and I made a note of this too, is that There's also, you know, when you say bureaucracy, the rules are for whom? There's also sort of an internal dynamic as to what extent do different parts of the organization adhere to the same rules? Usually that question is sort of focused on the vertical aspect of between the rank and file of the organization is subject to the bureaucracy, but to what extent does the leadership become subject to the same set of rules? That's a tension because to some extent, being a leader in an organ of any organization means that you are going to be subject to a different environment. There's very, very strong expectations that the rules, the bureaucracy applies to everybody in the organization, regardless of status or position. And then there are others where it's very clearly stratified. There's a set of rules, a set of norms, a whole institutional logic that governs different echelons within the hierarchy, or horizontally, one set of rules that govern the portions of the organization that are in this particular region, such as between a domestic and an international case. Those barriers, those internal barriers would seem to be, you know, natural sources of conflict within an overall institutional logic.
So Weber's conception of bureaucracy does allow for some of this nuance. So the first point of how there's, let's say you have a different, you know, an India office, US office, UK office, you have different rules slightly based on your local culture or your local business system, local, you know, the bureaucracy is based on a rational legal authority. So if the legal system itself is different, then naturally the details of the rules will be different. But what it doesn't allow for is the idea that there's no rules. So to your point, even the leaders should be subject to the same and impersonal rules. And that's the phrase that impersonality is about. You know, it doesn't matter if you're the founder of the company or the 100th employee or the 10,000th employee, the rules apply in an impersonal sense where it doesn't matter who you are. Whereas what we sometimes see in big, conceivably bureaucratic organizations, but like you said, with these complex logics, what we sometimes see is closer to what Weber talks about when he discusses traditional authority, where he has this really interesting concept of the double sphere. Essentially, he says that traditional authority, the ruler is bound by tradition, but free of rules. And so they kind of, as long as they're operating within a certain tradition, they can, if you imagine a religious leader, as long as they're able to interpret their behavior within the broad guidelines of the text, there's no specific rules of what they can and cannot do, or can they enrich themselves, can they not, and things like that. And so sometimes what we see then fits a bit more under that second kind of authority that that Weber discusses.
Yeah, and he did use a lot of examples drawing from religious organizations for that purpose. And there, the legitimacy really does become, to what extent do the lay people trust that the leadership, in this case, the religious leadership, has their best interests in mind? Once that breaks down, then that's when you start to question the legitimacy of the leadership. I don't know that this was necessarily highlighted, but when it comes to the traditional authority, there's a lot of personal conduct becomes kind of a factor. There is a sense of a bound around what would be acceptable personal conduct or the acceptance of personal risk in the exercise of their authorities that has a stabilizing, legitimating effect. What I'm sort of getting at now is, okay, a lot of discourse about, you know, when do leaders start to lose their legitimacy kind of varies according to the circumstance. And sometimes it's an emphasis on incompetence, that they have run an organization into the ground, personal conduct in which they do something that is considered reprehensible, tarnishing to the reputation. So at the same time where we have that stratification between the formal authority of the rules and the traditional authority, you start to get into questions about, well, okay, sometimes traditional authorities allow people to do things that would never be allowed within the rank and file. And the perception of unfairness perhaps is a far greater part of the discourse now than it was in Weber's time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it is. And I think that last phrase, particularly than it was in Weber's time, underlies much of this conversation that you and I are having, because a lot of it is that things are just so different now that some of the frameworks, if you try to fit it in, it'll burst at its seams. Another point I wanted to kind of bring up along the lines of things are so different now is the role of technology as well, right? So a lot of the idea of bureaucratic authority, well, rational legal authority, and hence the bureaucratic form of organization, was about the power of the technical knowledge of the people, but it's still vested in the person, the knowledge worker, or in to use Weber's term, the official, because he separates between an official and a worker. The official is the bureaucrat. But today, as we see more and more work, and specifically knowledge work getting automated and knowledge becoming a commodity, then if the very source of power of the bureaucrat is kind of gone, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, there's an argument to be made that our work gets even more bureaucratic, even though the base of knowledge is getting kind of outsourced to AI. The reason being, if we go all the way back now to Weber's emphasis on the rational legal authority and on bureaucracy, it was about reliability and kind of the predictable outputs. And what we see, of course, within the specific domain of software coding, is that AI is doing a lot of the work now, especially at the frontier labs when they're doing their own coding. AI is doing a lot of the code generation, and humans are becoming more of the QA, the quality assurance people, who are kind of proofreading, editing, making sure it's okay. So working on that reliability part of it rather than the knowledge itself or the knowledge generation itself. So an interesting thought experiment or interesting potential future is one where we are actually more doing just the bureaucratic parts and the other logics, the market logics, finding efficiencies in your processes, the innovation logic, finding new kind of creations are taken over by the AI.
That's a part that's a bit of a contentious right now, because despite the claims of increased efficiency, there's still the issue of like humans are needed a little bit more right now, more than just as quality assurance, because somewhere they still have to have that initial going in expertise to know what they're looking at. I don't have the articles immediately handy, but there's research that's finding out that there's an entire art to the prompting and the questioning of guiding the AI, of knowing or having the envisioning what it is that you want in order to get the AI to go in that direction, which suggests a bit more like a reversion to more professionalism if that stabilizes out and people figure out that there is an actual reliable diagnosis treatment structure construct to define that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there might be a new skill set emerging of its own, which we've seen with technological changes in the past, where the professional work gets displaced to new kinds of skills that didn't even exist or jobs that didn't even exist before the technology came along.
And then there's also the aspect of disinformation or misinformation, which is also, it's becoming an important field of study itself. I mean, it was already beginning with the hallucination problem. But now the deepfake and some of the other downsides of technology, where it's being deliberately used to deceive, to whatever.
And I mean, again, that's where reliability matters more and where the bureaucratic logic might make a comeback. Because if you're a peer reviewer, the reason for blind peer review is that impersonality of the bureaucratic logic, where you're not treating a paper differently because it's an author who's famous or not, at least in theory, and that avoids kind of, that keeps your information accuracy or your paper quality more reliable. And similarly, there's a lot of talk about how you're now more likely to trust institutional sources of news than kind of social media, as social media becomes more and more full of AI generated news or AI-generated content and misinformation, disinformation. Of course, it's a hopeful thought that people then turn to the institutional sources, but yeah.
Yeah, slop. That was...
Yeah, that was the word.
I was waiting to see if you were going to use the word slop there. Yeah. I think this continues to reinforce the idea that there's... Any organization at any given time has got some mix of institutional logics at play. Like there is not, I don't think we have an organization that really is a pure bureaucracy or a pure market. I don't think that that's necessarily bad as long as I'm calling up an AOM article from a few years ago that tried to map out, you know, what are the different ways in which these logics compete and where's that table? Two by two, where there's like, do you have one logic that is dominant or is it multiple logics that are equally at play versus whether the multiple logics have contradictory lessons? Like if you were to follow one logic, it would conflict with if you were to follow a different one versus whether all the logics really converge. You know, that way of thinking, without getting into the details of this article, but I'll cite it, and it's Besharoff and Smith, 2014, showed up in AOM Review. But what's useful there is if organizations are trying to navigate conflicting views, worldviews on how things should be done or whatever, this actually has some thoughts on diagnosing that problem. Because, like, if all of these logics are present in organizations, they're going to be conflicting. We can come up in the general case where bureaucracy and professionalism can naturally conflict, but they can also naturally cooperate. And so how do you navigate that within a given organization is something that's worth noting, because there's always going to be pressures to try to make things more efficient because resources... Phrase I like to say, aggregate demand always exceeds supply. There's never enough doctors to handle all of everybody's medical needs. And if it did, you'd encourage people to abuse it. So how do you try to strike that balance and not drive yourself into bankruptcy, I suppose?
So I think one thing to keep in mind as we look back on the whole discussion, as well as parts one and two of the episode, is that times have changed. Because in some sense, Weber's whole project across multiple works was a project of understanding at the time modern Western civilization. And why is it the way it is? Why is it different from other places? What are the different institutions, whether authority structures, political structures, religion, and so on? So naturally, if we try to fit in our current world and the current phenomena into the outputs of a project that was trying to understand modernity, it will be a kind of a tough thing to do. For me, the value of a lot of Weber's writing is in the kind of theoretical concepts we get from it, even if we don't use it as a overarching framework. Well, of course, to be fair, Weber himself was clear that these are ideal types. And so there's a lot of hybrid organizations and hybrid systems of control. But in today's world, even within the ideal type, probably there's variance. So for example, you could have a bureaucracy that isn't as impersonal as what Weber is talking about, or as clearly hierarchical as what Weber is talking about, while still following the logics of bureaucracy rather than traditional authority or charismatic authority. And so there's a lot of breaking apart that can happen of the overarching frameworks, but then those underlying conceptual tools, the concept of impersonal authority, the concept of kind of this hierarchical way of doing things, the idea that some places have more clear, limited jurisdiction between what your role is, what someone else's role is, are still very useful today and can still be the building blocks with which we build up new frameworks to understand the 21st century world as opposed to the time of Weber's writing.
And I'll just pile on that, complex problems require complex solutions and complex understanding. I think sometimes the discourse gets dominated gets dominated by desires for the simple solution. Sometimes that simple solution is like, you know, we hate bureaucracy because we don't like some of its vestiges. When in fact, some of the vestiges, I think, are actually more befitting to other institutional logics. And if you are careless and, you know, using a blunt instrument to try to fix a bureaucracy, you might very well make it worse. Unfortunately, it's really, really hard to engage in that complex conversation. But until we do, and until we can restrain ourselves from using blunt instruments, the arguments or the discourse is not going to go in the direction that I think we want.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.